Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, Episode 8, for January 24th, 2008. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and as always, I'm very happy to have you with me. I have a good show for you today, I think. I say that every time, but I believe it every time. I have three segments for you today. I want to talk a little bit about PC gaming, and the title of this particular segment is Relax, PC Gamers. PC gaming is not dead and is not dying. I'll try to expound on that a little bit. The second segment, I am going to take a look at a couple of games that I've been playing this week. I wrote about them on the blog. My descent into second childishness, two games, Parappa the Rapper and Guitaru Man. And what a great time I've been having with those older games. And I also want to talk in segment three about photorealism in games. And just the whole question of kind of this trajectory towards hyper-realism, increased realism, anything designers can do to add realism to video games seems to be a kind of irreversible trend. And I want to just look at that briefly and make a few comments about that and relate that to some similar trends that have occurred historically back in film and theater and other art forms that are older than video games. So again, thanks for joining me and off we go.
Kick, punch, it's all in the mind. If you wanna test me, I'm sure you'll find the things I'll teach ya, sure to beat ya. Nevertheless, you'll get a lesson from teacher. Now kick,
kick,
punch,
punch,
jump,
tap,
block,
block.
Once more now, kick,
kick,
punch,
punch,
jump,
tap,
and block. It's gonna get rocky. We're gonna move down to the next jockey. Now duck,
duck,
jump,
jump,
turn,
turn,
pause, listen carefully. Jump,
jump,
pause,
pause,
duck,
duck,
and turn,
turn.
Yeah, I see you're getting better. Kick to the limit in order to get her. Now kick, punch,
kick, punch,
block.
Well, if you're a PC gamer, you've been probably hearing about the death of PC games for, what, 20 years? 25 years? I mean, this slow decline and eventual death of the PC gaming industry is, you know, it's got to be one of the longest death scenes ever played by a theater actor in the history of tragedy, which is really kind of how this has been pitched to us for a long time. There's a tragic dimension to the fact that PC games have been overtaken by the consoles and handheld systems, that, you know, nobody wants to play PC games anymore and they aren't selling. And, you know, that a lot of us who play games, a lot of you who are listening to this podcast probably began gaming on a PC of some sort, maybe a Commodore 64 or, you know, one of the old Atari systems. It's sad, I guess, to some degree, that PC games don't have the same kind of high profile they used to have. But I think a lot of what we're reading and hearing is a little over the top and, in fact, really doesn't have a lot of relationship to reality. And I want to look at the question of PC gaming a little more closely and try to be a little more, I don't know, even-handed, clear-sighted, reasonable about what all this really looks like today. And, you know, no one knows where we're going in the future, but I think there are a few hints if you look hard at where things have been going and kind of the state of PC gaming today. I think it's a fairly easy thing to do to suggest that PC gaming is going to be just fine. Thank you very much. Now, a lot of the hand-wringing about the death of PC games is coming from some really bad sales numbers that were released recently on games like Crysis and Unreal Tournament 3. And these are pretty high-profile games. And Crysis in particular, you know, that game's been out there in the news, especially among hardcore gamers for a long time. A lot of expectations, very high expectations for that game. And, you know, the critical response has been very, very favorable. It's done very well. But for some reason, it just hasn't sold very many copies. Both it and Unreal Tournament failed to reach the 100,000 mark in sales. And Unreal Tournament in particular, as of, I think, early this year, and this number may be slightly old, but they were somewhere in the mid-30,000s, 33,000-34,000 copies sold, which is really horrible, especially given the history of that franchise. It's been a very popular game. And of course, there was Hellgate London, which was also very high profile, and some, you know, big names working on that particular game, a long time in development, and disappointing sales, and some real bug issues. And I think a lot of people still are waiting for that game to be able to run on their systems. Now, you could analyze individually why all three of these games haven't caught on, and there are probably a variety of reasons. Certainly, in the case of Crysis, having a certain kind of hardware rig that can run the game is a big issue. And I know the company has claimed that you can run that game on low-end systems, but I don't know. I saw it and played it at Gen Con, and I saw the kind of system that it was running on, which was very hardcore. You know, it was fine. It looked fantastic. But even there, it had a few stutter issues and a few frame rate issues. So, you know, I and maybe Unreal Tournament 3 is, maybe that franchise is running out of gas a little bit. And certainly from what I understand, I haven't played it, it appears that maybe they've run out of ideas with that one. Hellgate London's plagued by a lot of bugs. So, you know, with each of those games, you might say there are reasons why they didn't sell. But, you know, the fact is all three really underperformed, and they underperformed during a time in the year, the holiday season, when those kinds of games that people were waiting for a long time should have sold a lot. Now, the other issue, of course, and this is a big one, is piracy. And lately in the news, we've been hearing about the game maker Infinity Ward, which makes Call of Duty 4, and some really dire reports that they've been releasing to the public, documenting the rampant piracy that's been going on. Downloading of that game on torrent sites is just, according to them, you know, it's just run amok, basically a very dire situation for PC game makers in general, according to Infinity Ward, when you know, they say that something like half or maybe over half of the users worldwide of Call of Duty 4 that they're tracking online are playing illegal copies of the game. Now, that does raise an eyebrow. And clearly, piracy in PC games is a huge issue in a way that it simply isn't for console games. The result of this, of course, is that game makers like Infinity Ward are having to do a cross-platform release strategy for almost all their games. And you can see among the top games released in the last 6 months on the PC, games like The Orange Box, BioShock, Call of Duty, those games are all being released on the Xbox 360, PS3, and PC as well. And it suggests that these game makers don't have confidence in the PC platform as anything reliable for them in terms of sales. And if you track sales of those games I mentioned, their sales numbers on consoles, particularly the Xbox 360, are way, way higher than they are on the PC. People are playing games on consoles made by companies like Valve, who have a long history making games for PCs. But they've clearly reached a place where they understand the market is dictating to them, you can't just release these games on PC. So that's the PC gaming is dead side of the story. But there is another side. One of the things that you don't hear enough about when people talk about the death of PC gaming is that PC gaming is a very international market. And you get a distorted picture of PC gaming if you only look at the shelf at your local Walmart. Europeans play PC games in a higher percentage in terms of overall gaming than we do here in the States. They, of course, play console games too, but their numbers are larger among PC gamers still than they are among console gamers. And when you go to Asia, you know, it's a completely different story than here. PC gaming is huge in Asia, and it's sort of like all those crazy Japanese RPGs that are available for the PS2 that you never get to play in the States. A similar thing in Asia with PC games. There are just tons and tons of titles, particularly in Korea, that you'll never hear about, you'll never see, because they're particular to that market. And as we know, competitive gaming with games like StarCraft and, you know, real hardcore kinds of gaming experiences thrive in that Asian market, particularly in Korea. And we just don't think about that when we look at the American market. So if you go to Walmart and you see that shelf that used to be, you know, 10 feet long and now it's 3 feet long, and you get discouraged about that, just remember that, you know, you're looking at a picture that doesn't represent a very large part of the whole market that is PC games. And then, of course, there is World of Warcraft. Now, I have to tell you, I recently unhooked myself from that horrible addiction, and I'm clean now, feel good. I decided at a certain point that there were too many other games for me to play, and that the problem with World of Warcraft is that it's so demanding, especially if you decide to join a guild, and you notice that you've got all these games stacking up on the shelf that you're interested in playing, but you put them off because, you know, you need to get this one more thing done, or you need to get it to this one more level in World of Warcraft, and, you know, 3 months later and you still haven't played any other games. It's their great dirty little secret, you know? World of Warcraft, they make you feel adulterous for playing other games. Anyway, World of Warcraft, if you haven't heard, I think it was yesterday, Blizzard announced that they finally hit their 10 millionth subscriber. And these are active worldwide subscribers to the game. It now hosts more than 2 million subscribers in Europe, more than 2.5 million in North America, and approximately 5.5 million in Asia. Now, I told you Asia was big for PC games. Now, of course, we've seen this happening for a long time with World of Warcraft. It really is the 800-pound gorilla of PC gaming. But, you know, it does certainly suggest that a whole lot of people are willing to fork out, what is it, $15 a month to play a game on their PC, and with no end in sight. You know, for, I think, 6 months to a year, I keep hearing people say, well, you know, it'll fade. The bubble will burst. At some point, they're going to hit the downside. And as far as I can tell, they just keep growing. But I think what's important about World of Warcraft in terms of PC gaming is that it suggests not only that PC gaming is viable, but that you've got this user base of people who are very, very comfortable, a very large user base of people who are very comfortable playing games on the PC. And whenever that next thing comes, maybe it'll be made by Blizzard, maybe not, but, you know, whatever that next game is or series of games, you know, you've got a user base, a loyal installed user base of PC gamers who are ready to move on to whatever that thing is. It's hard when users go away to get them back. And yes, maybe PC gaming isn't as vibrant as it was 20 years ago, let's say, but they haven't left. I think they're more focused and more concentrated on fewer games. That's probably not a great thing overall for the industry, but it'd be a lot worse if those gamers had left forever. The other thing I would suggest too, and this really all regards Blizzard, who seems best to understand PC gaming, we shouldn't underestimate the impact that StarCraft II will have on PC gaming. And obviously, back to Asia again, it's going to be humongous there. I think it's undeniable that market is just rabidly StarCraft crazy, and StarCraft II is going to be huge there. But I think it'll be huge here too. I think it'll be huge in Europe. From what I've seen of the game, you've probably seen clips or on game trailers or whatever of what they're up to. It looks so, so good. And if you've tried StarCraft, if you've played it for any length of time, you know that it has that same kind of addictive quality that World of Warcraft has. Something about Blizzard and addiction. I don't know. They've got something in the water over there, I think. And of course, the little secret that hasn't been revealed by Blizzard yet is Diablo 3, which will also be huge, I think. Now, I have no reason to believe that that's absolutely true. It's a rumor, but they'd be crazy not to make that game. And I think once StarCraft II has hit, that crowd that plays Diablo, which I think is a different crowd than the StarCraft crowd, they're going to be hungry for their game from Blizzard. And I think Diablo is in the works and it'll be announced, I would think, within the next 6 months. Now, there's one other reason why PC gaming isn't going anywhere. And it has nothing to do with World of Warcraft or hardcore players at playing Blizzard games or Valve games or any other games. It has to do with casual gamers. We talked about Blizzard announcing WoW's subscription base of 10 million. Well, this might surprise you, but PopCap Games has sold over 12 million copies of Bejeweled, even though you can play that game for free. Now, what that says to me is quite simple. We hardcore gamers who play games like WoW, we really are still, in the bigger picture of things, a pretty small group. And the kinds of gamers that are out there who are interested in playing a game for 5 minutes or 10 minutes on their break from work are playing games like Bejeweled, and they're purchasing the game. I don't know how much it costs, but I think, what, $20 maybe? And what that means is that this kind of convergence of casual games, high-speed internet service, and people having access to that both at work and at home, and computers in everybody's home, those casual games are out there, and people are buying them. They're playing them. They're playing them online, and they're easy, and people love them. My mother plays casual games. She's a pretty serious casual gamer, if that makes any sense. And, good for her. That's also part of the future of PC gaming. And we mustn't forget that as the money flows in for those games and people like my mother play games on a kind of casual basis, it always raises the possibility that she will segue from that into a game that might be less casual, and that companies that are, realizing big money from these casual games, of course they're going to continue making more casual games, but it also raises the possibility of them branching out maybe an offshoot of the company to make more serious games. It's kind of the gateway drug argument where gamers who play casual games may very well play more hardcore games later. There is some evidence to suggest that that happens, even if it doesn't happen very often, even if only 15 or 20% of those casual gamers later play other games. That's still a positive sign. It still funnels more hardcore gamers into the PC and the console market, and that's good for everybody. So, death of PC gaming? I don't think so. We like binary definitions. We like all or nothing claims. And so when someone posts a story on a blog that PC gaming is dead or PC gaming is thriving, great, but probably the truth is somewhere in between the two. I think when we look at PC gaming, we see an industry that has morphed over the years from one thing to another thing. And in 5 years, in 10 years, it will have morphed from what it is now to another thing. That's how things are. I'm not worried about PC gaming. I don't think you should be either. I've been having a lot of fun the last couple of weeks playing two games, Parappa the Rapper and Guitaro Man. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, my guess is that, well, you've probably tried one of these games, if not both. And certainly in the case of Parappa, it was a big hit. And, you know, when that game arrived in the mail and I set it out on the counter, my wife saw it and she got a big smile on her face and she remembered playing it at a friend's house when she was in college, I think. You know, she looked at me and she was like, "You mean you've never played Parappa the Rapper?" And it's embarrassing, but you know, I didn't play it when it came out because I thought it was stupid. I mean, what can I say? I thought it looked stupid. I thought that, you know, the whole art style, I misjudged it for some of the same reasons I think we misjudge a lot of things, you know, kind of first appearances and, you know, you don't want to be embarrassed to like something that looks like a child's color form game. But this game, and I think it's even more incredible companion game on the PS2, Guitaro Man, they are such exquisitely designed and just beautifully rendered games that understand what fun is and understand what whimsy is. And when I say whimsy, I mean whimsy in like a really good sense. Whimsical games, whimsical movies, whimsical whatever, you know, that kind of thing can put people off because it makes them think it's going to be a trip to, you know, this kind of horrible cloying place. But the whimsy that is communicated in these games is this kind of perfectly innocent, perfectly guileless, and really very unselfconscious just embrace of fun. And what I really admire about both games, and they're very different games. I don't mean to suggest that they're like the same game, but you know, they're both music rhythm games. But what they both plug into is a kind of primitive, joyful gaming that it gets back to the very reasons why people make games: to have fun, to engage the player in, and to provide certain challenges. And in the case of both games, but particularly Guitaro Man, when I say challenge, I mean like kick you in the rear challenge. I mean, you know, kick you in the rear and then get up and you're real sore afterwards and try again and you get kicked again. It's a really hard game. But the sense of accomplishment when you beat a level in both of these games is really profound. And I got to tell you, those songs, in the case of Parappa and in the case of Guitaro Man, they bury themselves into your head. I mean, they burrow their way in there. And you'll go 2 or 3 days without having played them, and still rattling around in there is the song with the driving instructor, or, you know, the song with the reggae guy at the flea market. You know, that there's just a way in which these games and their songs and the play experience, they get under your skin, they put a smile on your face, and remind us that games, by their very nature, appeal to our most childlike qualities. You know, children like to play, and that's what we do when we play games. For some reason, culturally, if I'm blowing things up or shooting things or whatever in Halo, that's considered acceptable play. But if I play Dance Dance Revolution or Guitaro Man or whatever and make a fool out of myself, that can be embarrassing. And I'm embarrassed to admit that I fell prey to that some years ago when Parappa came out. And I sure am glad I remedied that, because, gosh, that game, it's just such a blast. You know, both of these games could have easily been sort of campy fun, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek or kind of snarky fun, where they kind of put on the face of a kind of childish innocence or this kind of silliness, but really in service of a kind of winking at the camera and, you know, isn't this all really very stupid, and aren't people stupid, and isn't everything stupid? And, you know, this particular kind of cultural comedy, which is really big right now. And, you know, hey, I laugh too. I mean, Sarah Silverman is, she's about the funniest person that I've ever seen on television. But, well, that's an overstatement. But anyway, I love her. She's very funny. But, boy, you know, a little of that goes a long way after a while for me. And I think with Parappa and Guitaro Man, you know, they don't go anywhere near that stuff. They're delightful, and they create this very perfect little self-contained world, and then they revel in that world, and there's no irony. It's just straight-ahead fun. Now, Guitaru Man, when it first came out for the PS2 in 2002, it was a terrible failure. I mean, nobody bought that game. And you can get a copy of it now, because it's such a little cult classic. You can get it on eBay for like $150. But when it first came out, no one bought it. And in fact, they re-released it for the PSP, a terrific version of the game. It's the version I played. Actually, well, I played both. I played the PS2 and the PS3, the PSP. But I found the PSP was a little easier for me, so I stuck with that. And trust me, if you decide to play the game, you'll want the easiest route, because it's just hellaciously hard. It didn't sell. And like I said, it has since become a very cult classic among gamers who really like rhythm and music games. And a lot of people know about Guitaru Man, but I have a theory that very few people have actually played it. You know, even the ones that claim that it's one of the great games, I think they claim that because of its reputation more than actual hands-on time, because the number of copies sold versus the number of people who claim it's the greatest music game ever doesn't quite add up for me. Anyway, what Guitaru Man gets right, and it does this extraordinarily well, is that it unifies gameplay, narrative, character, and puts it all into this perfect little musical package. What it really is a musical. I mean, if you look at this game in terms of its structure, and I'm talking about this from the point of view of someone who's, you know, a theater guy, you know, it's structurally built like a musical. You've got an exposition that occurs through song, but it also occurs through dialogue scenes. And the songs have meaning in the sense that they forward the plot. They aren't just stop and sing a song now and then go back to the dialogue. They're very unified, like more modern musicals. And it has this way of drawing you in, both in terms of lyric and music and also storytelling. And all three are necessary. And you throw in the gameplay, which has a very kinetic quality to it. You know, you have to make certain things happen in the game with your controller. It feels like you're playing the game. So the performance that Guitaru Man is doing, Yuwon, the character, the protagonist, his performance connects to your performance, because you're very much performing in this game. And all of that matters in terms of his whole evolution as a character. So unlike, say, Guitar Hero or Rock Band, where you're just basically pretending to play a guitar or drum or whatever, in this case, it's much more integrated than that. And, you know, it certainly isn't any kind of super sophisticated, you know, Pulitzer material here, but what it sets out to do, it completely succeeds at. And that is, it tells this beautiful little story about this character that you very much connect with and empathize for. And that story has a couple of interesting twists that pay off. The music is all in service of something bigger than the music. And in the end, it's a terrific challenge as in terms of gameplay. You know, you really, it tests you in the ways that the best games do. And your sense of accomplishment is great when you connect with that level, and you know, you suddenly get into a certain zone and you can defeat that level if you stay in the zone. And the more you think about it, or the more you observe yourself in the zone, the more likely you are to fall out of it. It really is a game that rewards the player who can kind of just turn off his brain and just kind of let go, feel the music, and just go with it. And that's a testament, believe me, to a well-designed game. The other thing I think that you'll find charming about Guitaru Man, if you have the chance to play it, is that it graphically it's really cool looking, and it is a world that has a certain kind of it's a bit anime, but it's also not just quite all that either. It's a very unique style, but the transformation that this boy makes, this really self-conscious, really insecure, and you know, a kid who just lacks every bit of charm and self-confidence that it would take to attract a girl. he transforms into Guitaru Man in these really cool little sequences, which are enabled by his sidekick, a dog that can talk to him. And you know, those transformations, which really make him into a kind of superhero. What he learns in the course of the story is that he actually possesses most of these skills by himself, and that he can do things by himself without transforming into some kind of superhero character. And so there's a whole lesson inside the game that I think has value. And that's true of Parappa too. There's a nice little lesson in there as well. And though they aren't simple-minded, they aren't just overly moralizing kind of drub you over the head lessons. They're charming, well-delivered lessons within the game that, to me anyway, work beautifully and integrate well with the music and the gameplay. So in the end, I'm really happy that I was able to let go of this ridiculous resistance to these quote-unquote kiddie games like Parappa the Rapper and Guitar Man. They are not kiddie games, although kids would enjoy them, and they are wonderful experiences for adults and anyone who cares about music rhythm games. If you really are a music rhythm game person, you've got to play Guitar Man and Parappa the Rapper if you haven't before. I'm very happy that I gave them a shot, and I'm very happy that I wised up and got over myself and thoroughly enjoyed both of these terrific games. I really hope you'll play both these games. If you don't like them, you can blame me. But believe me, you'll like them. You know, one of the best things about being a blogger is the community that builds up around your blog, if you're lucky, and I have been lucky. You guys know who you are, JC, Ben, LB, Daniel and Dennis, Corvus, Angela, Gabriel, Chris, and others who regularly come over to the blog and read a post and make a comment. It's really gratifying to me that you guys do this and that you pay attention to what I'm writing about, and I pay attention to your comments, and we have conversations. And you know, it was something I hoped that would happen when I started the blog, and I figured it might take a while. And I've just been delighted by the continuity that has developed as we go by, discussing whatever subject that pops up related to video games. And I can always count on, you know, some really thoughtful, intelligent responses almost every time I make a post. So thanks very much to all of you for that. One of the other great things about being a blogger is meeting other bloggers and joining that community of people who are thinking hard about video games and who really do care about this medium and write about them in ways that, you know, help me learn something every single day. And believe me, I read tons and tons of blogs. I'm a subscriber to, I don't even want to tell you how many, a lot. And some of them, you know, you kind of stumble upon them and you think, wow, you know, where have you been? Where have I been? I need to get with it. This is a really good blog. And one of those blogs is called The Artful Gamer by a fellow named Chris, who I've corresponded with, and we've had really terrific conversations. And I posted a while back on Planescape Torment, and my essay was, you know, essentially a great appreciation of that game. And I'd mentioned in that post that it seemed to me it would be very interesting to look at a game like Planescape Torment inside a game engine from today, like Oblivion or Mass Effect, and what would that game be like if you had that kind of graphical horsepower? And, you know, Chris gave that some thought, and we traded a few emails, and he decided to make a post on his blog about it, and we kind of invited each other into a little kind of cross-blog conversation, and I responded back. And what my post was about, and really in response to his, was this whole question of photorealism and why we seem to be driven towards a kind of ever-increasing infatuation with realism in video games. And Chris's point, and I think it's a valid one, is that, you know, there's a time and a place for realism, and that sometimes that's a very appropriate art style to adopt, but it certainly doesn't have to be the only one. And in his view, there's a kind of direct correlation between very strong attempts at realism and a kind of decrease in complexity and, you know, kind of a dumbing down of video games. And in his view, games like Planescape Torment, by nature of their simplicity graphically, they're really very text-based games in a certain way, that gives them the opportunity to introduce more complexity and more rich thematic aspects to the storyline and to the characters, and really just to be more ambitious games. Now, I think what video games have proven historically is that if a video game like Fallout or a Baldur's Gate, if they tell us a very good story with compelling characters, if they push us in certain ways that we're not expecting to be pushed, and challenge us, not just with gameplay or solving puzzles or something, but, you know, thematically getting at issues of identity and the meaning of existence is something that video games don't necessarily tread into very often, but certainly a game like Planescape Torment, a game like A Mind Forever Voyaging, they certainly do. And if you do that, if your game is that rich, then graphics really don't matter so much. And in fact, I would suggest that particularly if you're kind of an old school gamer, you've really become very accustomed to graphics that don't come anywhere close to realism. And you're perfectly happy with that, perfectly satisfied with that approach to storytelling or narrative in games. But I don't think that we can live there very much longer. And I think there's a wonderful kind of retro experience you can have with those games. And certainly I've been having them. I've written about them on the blog. I encourage players to try those games. But they are not going to be the future of video games. And whether we like it or not, in my opinion, realism is a powerful force. Most developers, most mainstream developers making games today, with some notable exceptions, are pushing the graphical power of the hardware that they're using. And mostly what that push is toward is some degree of realism or even photorealism. Now, I may not like that. I may not be terribly excited by that aesthetically, but I don't think we can deny, when you look at the titles that have come out over the last 6 months to a year, particularly on the Xbox 360 and PC, PS3, that photorealism is has become a kind of a de facto aesthetic. Now, I can see why people might worry about this, but I don't think we should. And here's why. Historically, every visual art form has had some kind of a trajectory towards realism. Sculpture, theater, film, painting. There's a strong kind of arc that you can see as a medium develops, that realism, sooner or later, will develop as the kind of de facto standard or that style that most people strive toward. In the theater, there's an interesting historical period around the turn of the 20th century when really there was a certain kind of obsession with realism, such that it became known as naturalism, which was perceived as more real than realism. And there was a fellow by the name of Antoine, another a Frenchman by the name of Zola and American producers who were sort of taking this up as well, David Belasco being an example. And they would do such things as they would take a butcher shop, a real butcher shop in New York. They would take it apart piece by piece. They would bring it into the theater, put it on the stage, reconstruct it exactly as it was in the actual butcher shop. They would bring in real pieces of meat, like real hunks of meat, hang them on hooks, and in every way possible, try to reproduce the reality of a butcher shop in a theater. Now, when you do that, it seems to me that you've left very little room for realism to go any farther. That's just about as far as you can take it in the theater. And so it's not surprising that shortly after that, people started to experiment with more abstract kinds of theater, that never-ending striving for realism became old news, passé, and other genres, other forms of theater like expressionism begin to arise, and you start to see alternatives to realism that definitely abstract the form in significant ways and kind of rethink how to make theater with a different aesthetic, with an aesthetic that challenges realism. You see this same thing happen in every art form: cinema, sculpture, painting, music. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that video games will somehow be exempt from this kind of trajectory. Certainly, realism kind of rules the day, but not completely. Some studios like Nintendo, Capcom, Konami, they make Atlas. They release games that aren't realistic or that are in fact very stylized, and that's cool. But I think that those are still seen by the public as, you know, kind of certain choices that you make that are alternatives to the dominant form, which is realism. My guess is that as we get farther down the line, as video games get closer and closer to realism and demonstrate that they can really do it, then we'll stop that train finally, that there'll be nowhere left to go. Unfortunately, in my opinion, we aren't anywhere close to the end of the line when it comes to video games and realism. And that's because despite, you know, the amazing strides that they've made and the hardware that they have available to them, the power that it has, video games aren't anywhere near producing realism because realism is really hard to fake. In order for realism to look like realism, it needs to be incredibly good at faking it. And the cinema has really mastered that. But I the cinema's been around for over 100 years, and I would argue that they've only relatively recently mastered that issue of total convincing realism. The films of today are extraordinarily effective at producing a kind of realism, even within the confines of a film that isn't realistic, and make you buy what you're seeing as real. So, you know, a real contemporary drama, of course, that's going to look realistic, but another film like The Matrix, for example, has to account for a certain kind of its own logical realism within the context of that world. And, you know, it took a long time, I would argue, for the cinema to really get good at that. And now it seems to me they can do it, you know, extraordinarily well. Video games are a long way off from that, in my opinion. And when you look at a game like Mass Effect, which is really, you know, the best people working very hard on trying to get that game to look like people talking and people having conversations and people doing mundane things, not the easy things, which are things blowing up or, you know, spectacular crashes or whatever. Those actually aren't terribly hard to do. It's the mundane little, you know, getting the walking animation to be believable. When characters touch each other and make, you know, physical contact, making that look realistic. You know, even today, a character grabbing onto a baseball in a baseball game, for example, and throwing it still looks really kind of polygonal and, you know, kind of fake. It's going to be a while. And so I'm not worried because I think we will eventually get there, and I hope it's not too much longer, because that'll finally free us, in my opinion, once we've gotten there, to move on and allow designers to develop art styles that that don't necessarily get bogged down in answering every little detail that's required of you if you decide to go with a realistic art design. You know, just a quick final thought on this subject, and this kind of connects back to the first segment on the so-called death of PC gaming. The real wild card in all of this, in my opinion, are indie games. And they really have come into their own in the last year or so. And it seems to me that as indie games like Aquaria, for example, which I posted about, Endless Forest, others, it seems to me that as those gain a kind of a higher profile and begin to exert a little more influence on the mainstream titles, that it's possible that we'll see more interesting deviation in the kind of art style that games adapt. We don't really have a figure that in gaming that resembles someone like an F.W. Murnau from the silent era of the cinema, or an Andy Warhol from the art world. We don't have someone who really comes in and kind of just destroys the whole aesthetic. You know, just basically says, this is all crap, I reject it, and I'm going to do something totally different. And that movement exerts tremendous influence, and you see all kinds of things shoot out of that rejection of the conventional, and a kind of replacing that with something aesthetically completely different. And that's not just a one-time kind of quickie aesthetic, but it in fact infiltrates the art world and the film world in all kinds of ways for years and years after. That's what I think indie games have the potential to do, and it does seem that they're beginning to explore that. And I really think that's terrific. I mean, that to me is the future. We have to pay attention to it. And if you get out there and buy an indie game, damn it. Don't just get the demo, buy one. And you'll feel so good about yourself. Well, I couldn't resist just one more little clip from Guitaru Man there. I've pretty much filled the podcast with music from Guitaru Man and from Parappa, so now your head can be full of them too. Well, that's the end of the podcast, and I want to thank you very much for joining me, as always. I am always grateful to receive email, and I'm sorry I didn't have time to get to any email today, but I promise next time I will. You can send me email to brainygamer@gmail.com. And the blog address is www.brainygamer.com. So take care, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Brainy Gamer podcast. Come on over to the blog, make a comment, introduce yourself, be part of the gang. You'll have fun. Thanks a lot, everybody. See you next time.